Thank you. Thank you for those very kind words. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's 10 years is a fair bit of time, but it seems very recent now that I'm back here again. I remember it pretty vividly. Had a great time. Sat back there in that corner there where there seems to be kind of a crib or something, but there was a seat somewhere there. And then I sat there, and I met some fine people that night. I met Paul. I met Jennifer Matthews, and I met Matthew Sweeney, who sat almost next to me back there, and he's sadly no longer here. And anyway, enough of this beginning. I'm going to read tonight mostly from my latest book, The Life That I Have, but I'll read a couple of other poems. And so I'll start out by reading two poems from my collective poems, 50 years. This poem called The Lion. Now this was a very early poem. It was written at a time in my life when I still thought death was really a bad trick. It's strange that the lion thinks of me as food. I touch my hand to the contours of my body, renewing acquaintance with them. I am aware that at 34, my flesh is not yet flabby, but lies with a minimal tautness on its frame. To respond sympathetically to the bones, I come across this body in the mirror and note the muscles work the moving parts as slowly they pull the arms above the head. Within my trunk, what labor is in progress? I hear not only the thudding of the heart, but the smallest veins tunneling through the skin. My lungs inflate as faithfully as my heart. My stomach lumbers on with its juicy task. My kidneys keep each other company. I have heard the surge of my blood at the worst times, standing in front of a class as the professor. I've lost the thread of some wiry argument just to follow the tide that retreated from my temples. While typing a poem only the other day, my mind of a sudden stooped to take my pulse. Imaginary fingers that felt my feet followed the mystery of the moving blood under the calves and thighs and the buttocks and back, into and out of the organs in search of the cells. 34 years of age and all was well, said sighs of relief made possible by my lungs. The lion lives at the circus as well as the zoo. At the circus he's not himself, and far away I can see him concentrating upon the whip that threatens to break and slap him across the back. He doesn't even know that I'm there. At the zoo, don't tell me it isn't another matter. The lion never misleads me with feigned indifference. Though we lie on the floor of his cage, zoo after zoo, so still that he scarcely seems to be alive. I know that behind his teeth he is waiting for me. The dark room behind his eyes has developed me. He sees my body smaller beneath its suits. He knows his claws can cut me out of the cloth. He has practiced killing me 1,000 times. There on the floor of the cage he paws my head. There on my broken limbs he licks the blood. Stripping of the skin, he has caught my ribs and worried my heart with a snarl of a shaking head. It's strange that the beast considers me his food. But there he is, and he has no doubt about it. And I'll read one more here. This is a poem called The Window Seat. I found Edna stretched out there, absorbing the sun. You look just like a cat, I announced, and put down my armload of books. Do you also purr? I purr when I feel like purring, she said. And then she produced a deliberate, slow, mouth-open yawn. That's how we yawn, she told me, after turning her face to the window. Fetch me some mice, he added, and maybe I'll purr. Will you purr if I pet you, I asked, leaning over the window seat and touching her hair. Cats have to be in the mood. Now go back to shelving your books while I scratch my fleas. And now I'll read from the latest book. This is called The Life That I Have. And it's a very fine book, if only for the cover, which I think is beautifully done by Salmon Publishing. It's a picture of me in 1978 reading by candlelight at King John's Castle in Limerick. Anyway, here are some poems from it. The book is divided into two parts. The first part is called Some Lives, and the second part is called Let's Say. The poems in Some Lives have this in common. They are all fictions, and they all are spoken by fictional narrators. Some are men, some are women, different nationalities, whatever. And so I'll read some of these to start off with. Here's a poem called Today. It is written that this would happen, but heedless, people attended to their usual affairs. Business affairs, family affairs, affairs. As if there were no tomorrow, as if there were no today, but always tomorrow. I really messed that up. When today did dawn, nothing much happened at first. Late risers, we slid into slippers. We saw through the bedroom window a delivery van on schedule stop at the shop across the road. We saw the barber at the corner, his scissors no doubt in order, throw open his door and shutters, ready for a head of hair. Then we shuffled, stretching and yawning, into the kitchen to start coffee, half hearing a weather report. We intended to go back to bed and into each other's arms. Now, among the few that God spared, our regrets include not being able to finish even our first cup of coffee. On the wall, I open the shutters, then wait for the room once again to adjust its composure. The let-in sun has fallen on the wall, exposing exacting eyes, revealing the bland hopes of inspirited lips. That was me, all right. Soon my driver will ease in, fresh as a Jonathan apple, his demeanor as ever overrating his probable future. He will take me to hands that will touch with perfected skill, to a voice that will ease. I have the means. But for the moment, what I have is this room and the scrupulous sunlight, and large as life on the wall, my outworn self. The empty glass. The chattering slowly resumed, nudging a fantasy toward the edge of extinction. I was struggling to keep it alive when the principal player herself, I'll call her Madge, detached from her group. Tall, a little edgy, lithe, she moved my way as if, I thought, toward someone directly behind me. Just the moment before I'd envisioned her body sprawled on a welcoming bed, her garments casually strewn. Now, as she halted before me, with sweater and slacks, which concealed and announced her body, remained in place. Her smile, however, was the same, ample and brave. "My glass is empty," she told me. "Would you care to fill it?" Thank you. little lady. They all went into the rec room after dinner, stretching and patting their bellies to settle their rubs at poker. "A terrific meal, Larry," the old one said. "That sweet little lady of yours is a hell of a cook." The door swung shut on their heels. As I cleared the table, I could hear the men laugh. Larry, no doubt, was telling one of his jokes. I could see the shine on their fat faces as they laughed and nodded and drank their Jim Beams. As I cleared the table, somewhere a young woman just out of college sat alone in her room. She was sliding a diamond on and off her finger and reading over again the architect's letter. Of all the bright young men in the world, only he had read the fine print on her sensitive soul. And of all the available women, only she had been granted custody of his heart and home. The daughter God gave me. This daughter God gave me yawns when she drags herself out of bed. Then she yawns through breakfast and, still yawning, mopes out of the house to meet her bus. I imagine her yawning as she pokes her way down the hall to her first class. I've tried high-energy breakfast bars. I've tried to enforce early nights. I pray and I pray. Dr. Gregg says that I shouldn't even think about it. He tells me I'm worrying myself to an early grave. He tells me it's normal enough for a girl of 12. But I do think about it, wondering what I've done wrong, wondering if something dark possesses my child, if God is punishing me for bringing her into the world. And one more from this section before I move around a bit. Out of the sack. Jill spilled them out of the sack. Oh, excuse me, I'm starting to start again. Jack spilled them out of the sack onto the grass. And we all stared. Marion, who stood at my left, gasped and she grabbed my elbow. Sidney, lighting his pipe, let the match burn his fingers. Earl has always looked bored, but of course he was not. Then Enid got down on her knees and, taking great care, held one up to the light. "I made them myself," Jack told us. The second section of the poem, of the book, excuse me, is called Let's Say. And some of the poems there, but not all of them, are personal. What all of these poems do have in common is that they're not first-person fictional narratives. Here's one called A Version of the Muse. "You should write a poem about this," she said, as she pulled out a biro and plunked it down on the table. "About that biro?" I asked her. "You think I should write a poem about that biro?" "No, of course not this biro," she said, extracting sweets, tissues, a notebook, combs, and a cluster of keys. "It's in here somewhere," she added. "What's in there?" I wanted to know. "Is it whatever it is you decided is grist for my mill?" "It's not what's in here," she said, turning her bag upside down and spilling out sundry wares hither and yon. She rose from her seat and gave me a leveling look. "Now see what you've made me do." "What I made you do," I said. I reached down from my chair to snag the lipstick tube that was rolling over the floorboards. "It's this bag, it's this bag," she announced, snatching the tube from my hand and shaking the bag in my face. "It's this bag you don't want to write about, but this bag is my life." Boyhood paths. Excuse me while I find my... This is from a section of poems in her called Some Early Days. Boyhood Paths. One aimless Saturday we lost ourselves, Dick and I, in a wood. An overgrown path between hostile trees failing to point us homeward. As the day subsided, we found at last a break from dark, towering limbs and low-lying, bruising branches. We walked out into sunlight. Into sunlight and into a long, familiar landmark. A cinder path alongside railroad tracks. As the locomotive drew near, we dug in our pockets, placed palm-soiled nickels on a shiny rail. Then, standing as close as we dared, we waved as always to the engineer. Then we scurried between the ties to look for our treasure. We could have spent our wealth on 6-ounce Cokes, or if too thirsty for that, on 12-ounce Pepsis. Instead, we pocketed beautifully flattened coins, good value for our money. Remembering Bonnie Charnier, my homeroom teacher. There's a reference in this poem, there's a statement, ready, heady. That was a term readily understood in America for many years. Heady refers to Hedy Lamarr, an exceptionally beautiful star of the movies. Ready was, of course, suggested. Remembering Bonnie Charbonnier, my homeroom teacher. Along with the other newly pubescent boys, I stared in fascination past her see-through blouse at the pure white bra that showcased her trim breasts. Disregarding convention, we called her Bonnie. Once in her English class, when she lost control, Bonnie screamed that we should all jump out the window. Then, fighting back tears, she ran out into the hall. But she was a ready heady, an expression much in vogue at the time. Anyway, I called her that in a sentence I wrote to illustrate an example of grammatical structure. When I read it out loud, she laughed along with the rest. Homeroom was a prime feature of junior high. Here, attendance was taken, announcements shared, details of our lives recorded. In my homeroom, there were 22 students, in addition to Joe Smedley, who lived at a non-existent address on North Laclede Station Road. On the first day when we had to fill out forms, I gave Joe Smedley a life. An entry to records in the principal's outer office was lax enough for me to back it up. Then each time Bonnie read the roll, when she came to Joe, we all, including Bonnie, had a good laugh. It was good-natured fun till the school nurse came looking for Joe one day, asking Bonnie why Joe had never shown up for his eye exam. We snickered, and the secret was out. But Bonnie, I hope God has blessed her, assured the nurse that she had no idea who was responsible for Joe. And lucky for me, Bonnie held her ground in the principal's inner office. If I had listened to Bonnie, I'd have jumped out the window. But she did conduct her classes in a see-through blouse. And more than that, she did save my ass. Coffee with Madame de Vaux, a reminiscence. Paris, 1960. From my third floor walk-up, I make my way down narrow, dusty steps to the first floor. I'm calling on Madame de Vaux to pay her my first month's rent. Just old enough to be my mother, or possibly an older lover, she greets me in English and offers to make me coffee. Then, grinding her coffee beans, she says, "You must study French. If you don't speak better French," she adds, "you are nothing here, nothing." She sighs and shrugs her shoulders. "I'm not here to learn French," I reply, as she pours boiling water on the beans. "I'm writing poetry. Oh, yes, she replies, but you must get a job or else you are nothing here, nothing. When we sit drinking our coffee, she tells me I must meet the daughter of a French family she knows. The daughter will help me speak French and will also make use of her English. They are a very good family, she adds, breaking my silence. They will have you to dinner. But I have a girlfriend, I remind her, and she pushes aside her cup. Oh, yes, the one you brought here, she says, that Hollandaise. She stands up and shrugs her shoulders. When I rise and thank her for coffee, she reminds me that I must have my post addressed to her care. Otherwise, she tells me once again, you are nothing here, nothing. I have a number of poems set in the back garden at my home in Killispoolinan. I'll read a couple of these. This one's called Logs. Carrying logs from the back garden, I walk over blackened leaves stuck hard to the ground. These logs, no longer frozen together, still manage to produce a chill that penetrates my gloves and my waxed jacket. A hot whiskey, I think, will be just the thing. Behind me, a massive limb, having lost its annual battle with winter wind, retains but a thin hold on the cypress tree. It will stay that way until John Murphy arrives with his chainsaw. In the kitchen, I feel almost warm as I sip hot whiskey and think that we will have logs aplenty for winters to come. Thinning out. Just what will occur this morning in the back garden? Will I find myself distracted by those odds and ends dumped at the side wall? Will I spend an hour or two separating kindling wood from usable scraps? Or will I perhaps miss my step on a stone step and thus trigger admission to a new adventure in a new world? No, what I will do, most likely, is sow several short rows of autumn king carrot seeds. I'll offer opportune life to a chosen few, those that not only break ground, but live long enough to survive the thinning out. Now, I'm going to go back to section one. But before I do, I'll read a couple of uncollected poems. Maybe just to show you that I'm still at it. Here's a poem called A High-Speed Abridgment of Courtships 3. A mutual friend introduced them, and for some weeks they would tiptoe around and around her widowed mother before sneaking off to drink red wine in his room. After the night she averred she'd found her soulmate, he convinced himself for some little while that the one she had in mind was actually he and was not her widowed mother. At a drunken party he attended, a woman passed out. He watched as they bore her away to be met, as she told him later, by her sire, the stern professor. For some days they conveyed cold lager back to his room, till the memorable night she let slip that she needed his help to be rescued. He attended a faculty pig roast, where he met a woman in open-toed shoes. Your toes, do they always curl up, he asked. And of course they did. Well, after this very propitious start, they met from time to time, and after some time she bought him a bottle of dry sack. And then all, I said all, was well. The bird in the glass house. The small bird I find in the glass house flies into one pane of glass after another, then awkwardly flutters to the floor. It pauses a moment, its dark black feathers held tight to its body, and then taking wing again, it smashes into another of the glass panes. I enter, sliding the door wide open, and slowly advance to where the bird is resting in a far corner. Gently, I move to nudge the bird toward the open door, but as soon as I put my hand in place, the bird shrieks as if in pain. I imagine the frantic beating of its four-chambered heart, and I back off. The bird responds by crashing into a near corner, and rising in haste, it dashes off to each of the other three corners. Each time, it ignores the only passage to freedom. I leave it alone to manage as best it can, but after I do, it flies past the open door again and again. The open door, after all, looks just like another pane of glass.
Knut, so Knut, did you publish that recently?
It's been accepted, but I don't think it's been published.
I just read it somewhere. The last week or two, I read it somewhere.
Oh, well, good. I guess we'll be getting the magazine soon that it's in. Back to the life that I have, and I'll start again with section one of the fictional narratives. A poem called Yellow Beer. That day we fished and swam. That night we sat by the fire, frying what we had caught and emptying cans of beer. It was yellow beer, years before the better stuff came along, and with it, the benefit of choice. After a while, we moved into the tent, where we came together, shyly at first, but concluding in a sweaty bliss. In the morning, we drank coffee while eggs sizzled in the pan, all the time finding excuses to touch each other. Well, that's how I remember it anyway. It was the first really meaningful day of my life. It was a coming together of two hearts meant for each other. She sees it differently now, and perhaps she did then. I was the yellow beer, it turns out, before the better stuff came along, before the benefit of choice. As moments go, I was splashing water on my face, but then when I reached for a towel, the towel was not there. The towel was not on its rail. The towel had not fallen to the floor. As a matter of fact, the towel was circling my neck, and hands were pulling it tight. This all happened in a moment, but as some moments do, this moment went on and on. Even now, some years later, the moment stays with me. But for the person whose hands have been holding the towel, the moment is long past. It may have been over by the time I dragged him across the floor, or it may have ended at some point in the boot of my car. It was certainly over by the time the bubbles were gone. The two of us. Get the page number. Reverend Miller brushed the token dirt from his fingertips, and the rest of us stood there waiting for someone to move, for someone to say something, or for something, anything, to happen. And then someone did move. And then gradually, by themselves or in small groups, some others drifted away, leaving behind the usual muffled remarks. And then there were only the two of us, on opposite sides of the dug-up earth, avoiding the few steps that would bring us closer. She was in black, of course. The expression drawn on her face looked incredibly real. "I have to go now," she said, abruptly breaking the silence, "or they'll talk about us." She took a small step. "And please don't call by the house," she said. "I'll phone you later. We meet for lunch now and then, just the two of us, and we bide our time." A matter of life and death. I stare into the crowded park. She has to be there somewhere in the mix of holidaymakers. At first, I followed her through a crowded department store. Easy to do, you might say, with her long yellow hair and her tangerine dress. And then I kept her in sight through a sequence of busy streets that led to this park. And now, in front of my eyes, she has managed to disappear behind a queue for an ice cream. You would almost think she knows it's a matter of life and death. Her probable death, if all goes well. My dubious life, if it doesn't. Against all odds. The pool hall is crowded with survivors, most of us huddling on the floor, blankets pulled tightly around us. The more serious cases stretch out on the tables. Lights flicker, go out, come back on. Aside from a few low moans, it is deathly quiet. We could be at the end of the world, and it dawns on me that it is the end of the world. If so, what a world it has been. Against all odds, I've enjoyed the love of a good woman, a comfortable home in New England, good food on the table. I spent the last half of my life looking up at a high meadow of browsing cows and down past our village to the lake and its bobbing boats. It is here I've perfected my art to laugh and ordered my soul. I adjust my blanket where it slipped off my left shoulder, taking pains not to disturb my broken arm. The lights are flickering again. The air is decidedly colder. I look up toward the faltering bulbs, ready for dark. And now, lest you think that every poem in this section is grim, I'll read you a poem called A Mail Order Bride. Dad married a mail order bride. It cost him a registration fee and a shipping charge, not to mention some incidental expenses. But he says it was worth it. She prepares his breakfast each morning and scrubs his back. Dad certainly seems pleased with himself, and he's promised to let me have his inflatable doll. Okay, over to the second part again. Poem, also going back to my childhood, called Bigler. He drilled without Novocaine, and I, a young boy, knew no better. One time when I clamped shut my jaw, my mother proclaimed that she was so mad she could spit. At 18, having found my own dentist, I relaxed in the relative ease of a numbed jaw. Years after that, in my dead father's apartment, I found the love letters Bigler had written to my mother. Now, I think you're probably all aware of someone who's somehow or other President of the United States. Here's a poem called Watching the Donald. His train of thought, one announced, tightly gripping the arms of his hapless chair, consists of a locomotive and a caboose. "Not so," declared the other, restraining herself from smashing her television. "You left out the long and rattling line of empty boxcars." Margaritas. margaritas tonight. And I think of our friend Greg. One night in Killis Pugilan, he enlarged on his hopeful plans while explaining his very own way to make margaritas. Margaritas tonight. And I think of our son Morgan. At ease under beach umbrellas on the sun-swept seaside of Puerto Veracruz, he drank margaritas with us. Morgan, who snorkeled at Puerto Veracruz, now works for Nintendo and has also set up his own business in Washington State. Greg, who moved west to California an ocean and more away from Killis Pugilan, one day placed a gun to his very own head. The life that I have. This is preceded with a quotation from an American poet, Theodore Retke, who said, "Weeds, weeds, I love you." I'm digging up morning glories, once again wondering who named them that. Invasive, they have spread themselves from one spot to another, tangling themselves around seedlings. I push my trowel as deep as it wants to go, while the sucking soil attempts to exert control, but it's seldom I get all the roots. Warm and itchy, I shake loose what earth I can and take pains to put back the worms. Dandelions are easier, their broad leaves belying their easily accessible roots. These, along with dockweed, thistles, nettles, and countless weeds I cannot identify, go into my buckets. In a better life, Ratke, I might come to love your weeds, but in the life that I have, they are my weeds, and I'm hauling them off to the dump. I'll finish with a poem called On Being 90. The clown is quieter now, but somewhere in the back of my closet is a large red nose. I try to keep on the move, but at times I find my feet on separate paths. I like to think that my heart is as big as ever, even when it doesn't keep time. If I had a chance to do all of it over again, who would I be? So what if I'm not quite 90? Don't they say it's a virtue to look to the future? Perhaps the first 90 years will turn out to be only a good beginning. Thank you all very much. It's been a great pleasure reading to you.